believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest tonight grew up in Pocahontas, Arkansas, and earned an MA and a PhD in government from Claremont Graduate School. In 2000, he became the 12th president of Hillsdale College. He's one of the world's leading experts on the life of Winston Churchill and the author of Liberty and Learning, The Evolution of American Education. His name, Dr. Larry Arnn. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything is Possible, presented by Trust in Us on News Talk 760 WJR.
Now back to Anything is Possible with Jack Krasula on News Talk 760 WJR. Brought to you by Trust in Us, a world-class executive search firm. Now, here's Jack.
We're with the president of Hillsdale College, Dr. Larry Arnn. Doctor, welcome. It's an honor to have you.
Honor to be with you, Jack.
Can we start by talking about your childhood and your parents?
Okay. My dad is a retired school teacher in Pocahontas, Arkansas, still alive. And my mom passed away 5 years ago. They both grew up on Depression-era farms in northeast Arkansas. My dad is the only one of his generation or before to go to college. He went on the GI Bill. There's always a lot of books around when I was growing up. My dad's a school teacher. We were supposed to make good grades, supposed to put school first. If I hadn't have been slow and small, I probably would have put athletics first. As it is, I played every sport and liked it a lot, but wasn't as good at that as lots of people were. And I had a great upbringing. Pocahontas, Arkansas is still a town of 6,000 people. I'm going there in 2 days to see my father. And it's a wonderful place to grow up. It's a little bit like Hillsdale, Michigan in that regard. It's the middle of America, and it's solid, and it's serious, and it's fun, and it's safe. And I grew up in a world walking around where everybody I saw knew who I was.
What did you learn from your mom, Doctor, and what did you learn from your dad?
My mom is one of the toughest people I ever met. She's everybody's mother. She's a wonderful lady. It didn't snow much in Arkansas as it does up here in Hillsdale, but when it would snow, the best snow hill, sled hill, was beside our house, and the whole town was asked to have hot chocolate. And a lot of the time I was growing up, my mother worked, sometimes two jobs. My dad always worked two jobs. And I learned from her, she's a model. She's a loving, tough, firm person. And you couldn't watch her without seeing toil for the things that were dear to her, and every good thing was dear to her. My dad, who's, you know, still alive and a friend of mine and a brave, good man, I learned from him to read, to like to read, to talk about books. He liked to do that. Today, if you want to make my dad happy and you send him a Christmas present, send him a big old fat book. History books are best, but just about anything, any good, he'll read it. And he's one of these guys, you send books to him, and he does read them. And years later, he can tell you what they say. And so he believed in things like that. And, of course, I grew up in a world where you were supposed to tell the truth and be honest and work hard and know right from wrong. I used to tease my mother after I got grown up because one of her favorite sayings was, "We always thought we should teach them right from wrong." And I would say, "Mother, when did you ever teach us right from wrong?" And she would say, "All the time, but anyway, you already knew." And that, you know, there's a kind of philosophic lesson in that, by the way, because it is true that the moral things are available to the sense. Everybody knows you shouldn't steal. People who do it, I once saw some great interviews by Ted Koppel in a maximum security prison in Texas. And he would talk to these guys about the terrible things, they're all men, about the terrible things they'd done. And none of them said, I'm in the wrong, they would all say there was some reason why it was okay to do it, while allowing that that kind of thing is not okay. And so the point is, my mom was a kind of exemplar of that, and my dad, he would talk about that as a kind of intellectual thing, too. So I grew up in a household like that. There was some learning around, but there was hard work by them more than us. And we came to watch that and see what that meant.
You're the author of Liberty and Learning, The Evolution of American Education. When you sent that book to your dad, what did he say to you?
Thank you. My dad is, my dad thinks that he'll, my dad's the kind of man who would think the place where I work is really good, and he's proud of me that I work here. And the things that are in that book, I'll tell you what dads think about that. Just the other night I was talking to him, and I had a spell in college where I was, as you know, most kids do growing up, where I was very much of the view that my dad was wrong about political things. And he used to say to me, it was incredibly annoying, he said, well, you know, these things swing in through life a little bit like a pendulum, and they might go out too far in one direction, but they'll find their way back. And, of course, that was a form of talking down to me. And he reminds me of that today because, come to find out, he was right. It was right for him to talk down to me. And what he thinks now is he thinks he's proud. I'm a successful man, and he likes that and thinks that's really great. But also he thinks I stand for things that are good, and so he's proud about that.
We're talking to Dr. Larry Arn. He got an M.A. and a Ph.D. in government. And then, Doctor, you decide to spend your life in education. Why?
Well, you get the charm of learning. And, when I was growing up, I was always going to go to law school. And I was a good student, and I was admitted to some very good law schools from Arkansas State, where I went to undergraduate school, the local place. And I was going to go to a nationally famous law school, one of the few elite ones. And I took a class. It was a mandatory class taught by a man who's now a friend of mine, named Wallen. And I had to take this class in ancient political thought. And I only took it because I had to take it. And I really didn't want this guy because he had the reputation of being very arrogant. And I had to take it. I had to take it when I had to take it, and I had to take it from him, therefore. And about 2 weeks into the class, we were reading Plato's Republic. And I can show you the passage in Plato's Republic in Book 1 that we were reading. And I said, I raised a question. I said, why should anyone get to be a ruler over anybody else? And because Plato's Republic is about construction of the best regime, which comes to mean along the way that the regime run in the interest of justice by the people best qualified. And he said, that's a good question, and we'll get into that. But he said, you have to remember, there's an argument that's different from the argument who should rule. It's an argument, what is the purpose of rule, which is a form of the argument, what is the purpose of life? And I remember I was thunderstruck by that. I can remember what the classroom looked like that day. And I looked up and I said, wow, that'd be a great thing to know about, wouldn't it? And so I put my law school admissions on hold, and I went what I thought would be 1 year of graduate school, because I thought, you know, you'll go and in a year you'll learn. I was arrogant myself in those days. And I would then go and be a lawyer, but now I would know the purpose of life. and so I got to studying it, and I decided, wow, you should just study this. This is really great. That's why I did it.
We're talking to Dr. Larry Arn. I'm Jack Krasula. This is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
This is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR with Jack Krasula.
We're talking to the 12th president of Hillsdale College. Hillsdale was started in 1844. 164 years old, Dr. Larry Arn. Doctor, how was it you ever became the president of Hillsdale in 2000?
Interesting story. I was among the people who didn't apply for the job. The job came open in 1999, and there was a national search, Hillsdale's well-known thing. And for some reason, I got on their list, and I didn't apply. They expressed some interest in my applying, and I, you know, Bill Buckley and a couple of other people who were close to the college told them I might be good, and I didn't apply. And the reason is I didn't want to be a college president. Most of my friends are faculty members, and I know what they think of them. And so I thought, who would want to be that? And I got to talking with them. They called, and they, through intermediaries a couple times, they said, you should just send us a letter of interest. And I didn't, and it got in the paper that they were down to a short list, and they called me, and I thought they were calling me as a reference for somebody else who was applying. And no, they said they want to talk to me, and I said, but you already have a short list. And they said, but your name is on it. And I said, that can't be. I haven't applied. And the man, Bill Broadbeck, chairman of the board, arriving here in town a little bit later today, said, well, that's why I'm calling. I want you to apply. And I said, you know, I don't want to do that. Told him why. That interested him, because I took the position the job couldn't be done in a modern college the way colleges are today. It's a useless job. You go raise money for stuff you don't believe in and become an apologist for things you don't believe in, and everybody regards you as some form of prostitute, maybe. And that's an extreme way to put the point, but the point is in there. So I said I didn't want to do that. And along the way, he wanted to explore all that with me, and he sent me some documents. It was partly by chance. He sent me some documents, but among them was the founding document of the college. And it's a very beautiful document, and if you've studied the history of America or of the Civil War, you will recognize immediately what the words in it mean. Its preamble is simply beautiful. And I read that, and I thought, wow, that's lovely. Gosh, didn't know that. And I cooked up with them then the plan that we would run the college out of that old document, and there would be no other law here. It wouldn't then be me telling people they had to do things because I want them to, because, you know, I have a PhD, and I'm a well-educated man, and I've been a very successful student, but there are about 130 or 40 other people here who meet that criteria, too. So I thought, it won't be what I want. It'll be what this says. We'll all do what this says. And that notion became a sort of commanding notion among us in the search process. And so we worked out a way to manage the college. And instead of really interviewing each other, we were sort of working together. And then we found we liked it, thought we could implement that plan, and that's how I became the president.
In its 164 years, it's never taken $1 from the federal, the state, or any local government. Why?
Well, it you know, for a long time, of course, there wasn't such money available, and the whole thought of the nation was that colleges, which train the leadership of America, should be separate from the government, because to have a free and limited government, you have to have a society that's separate from the government. And so you wouldn't want it running, especially colleges. And there was no idea until well into the 20th century that it should be that the federal government had any constitutional power to be involved in the management of colleges in any way. And that's a very remarkable fact about the country. When the idea grew up that federal government would start giving money to colleges, we refused in the beginning to accept any direct money from the government on the ground that I just stated, that, you know, we should be a private college independently training people, among other things, to love their country, love of America. You know, Hillsdale College has a war record. I mean, I invite anybody to compare the war record in the great wars of America with ours, and we have nothing to apologize to anyone about that. And so that's the spirit, right? And so we didn't, in the 50s, late 50s, 60s, and 70s is when all this stuff was born. And we made a decision, our board of trustees back then, sometimes narrowly, made the decision not to accept any money from the government. We did make the decision to let students accept money from student aid from the government, as we had done right after the Second World War with the GI Bill. And we thought that's aid to the students, and especially the GI Bill, which is a war defense measure, is clearly constitutional, whether the other student aid is or not. But it's the student's contract. In the 70s, because that student aid was coming here, we got a demand from the Department of Education that we comply with hundreds of pages of regulations. We got into a dispute with them about that. We sued them finally. They denied, turned us down through their administrative hearing process. We took them to court, and we lost 9-0 in the Supreme Court. So then we got rid of the student aid, too. And the reason we won't have that is two reasons, one general and one specific, a subset of the general. The general reason is it's not a good way to run anything to have hundreds of pages of detailed rules for people to follow. Human beings are thinking people. By the way, you, Jack, whom I happen to know, and your show is a exemplar of this great fact. Human beings are naturally self-governing individuals. So what you should do with them is agree the goals and the ways of working, and then let them do their jobs. And in Hillsdale College, in the management of the whole college, in every part, students, faculty, and staff, we don't have as much as 100 pages of rules. But if you take Title IV, which is the student aid section of the federal aid, it's almost 400 pages of stuff you have to comply with, and it's unreadable. And so you become an organism devoted to compliance, which is different than an organism devoted to doing its job. That's the first problem. And by the way, that's a problem that besets every corner of American government. People should understand that that is very dramatic, and it is very new. It hasn't been for very long that this has been true.
We're talking to Dr. Larry Arnn. I'm Jack Krasula. This is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
You're listening to Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Brought to you by Trust in Us, a world-class executive search firm. Once again, here's your host, Jack Krasula.
Welcome back. We're with Dr. Larry Arnn of Hillsdale College. Doctor, you've got a famous monthly newsletter that's entitled Imprimis. Share that with us.
Well, it's 30-some years old now, and the rule is we'll send Imprimis for free to anybody who wants to get it. The word Imprimis means in the first place. And it's a monthly article taken from some speech that's been given to Hillsdale College on our campus or off. There are more than 100 such speeches given a year, and we pick 12 of them and stick in there. And the list now is more than 1.6 million people a month in every corner of the land. And it's an old publication. We don't give your name to anybody else. If you want to get on it, you may. We send it for free, as I say, and we do get, the college gets a lot of support from Imprimis, but not really by asking. People volunteer if they want to support the college. And if you want to get Imprimis, you can get it for free, and you can put anybody else on to get it. Some people put people on because they like the kind of thing that's in it. Some people put people on because they think what's in it will annoy them. And it's easy to get off if you don't want to get it. As I say, we won't give your name to anybody else. It's an old outreach program. And it's an interesting thing that it was started because if you just think, probably for our competitors, 30% of their student-associated revenue comes from the government, state or federal. That's a big revenue stream for them. And we don't have that. And so we live entirely on voluntary contributions. And our way of getting those is through Imprimis mainly, tell people what our principles are, what we think. And it's a selection of interesting articles, but you can see sort of what they are about and the posture of the college. And if you like that kind of thing, you might volunteer to give us money. or support us in some other way, or send your kid here. If the kid's got to be pretty smart to get in. And if you don't like that kind of thing, well, that's, you know, it's a free country. You don't have to.
How can a listener get on your list?
They call the College 800 number, 1-800-437-2268. Call that number. You can get on in Primus for free, or you can go to www.hillsdale.edu.
We're talking to Dr. Larry Iron, and I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
Welcome back to Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Presented by Trust in Us, a world-class executive search firm. Now, here's your host, Jack Krasula.
We're with Dr. Larry Iron, who's been a trustee of the Heritage Foundations since 2002. Doctor, the average increase last year at a Big Ten school was 11%. Last year, Hillsdale was less than 1%, 0.8%. In the last 8 years at Hillsdale College, you've averaged 2.5% increase per year. How do you do this?
Well, we watch our costs, and just like any business, it is actually true that our costs per student have been going up less than the rate of inflation. And the specific thing that we've done here, we have about 20% growth in students. We're full now, and we've had about a bit more than 20% growth in numbers of faculty. But we actually have fewer administrators working here than we had 8 years ago when I came here. And we do that just by searching for efficiencies all the time. Every summer, every person here is deployed to help us look for more efficient ways to run the college. And we haven't fired people, but we, you know, have reduced by attrition. If we have a surplus here, we have a goals and performance system that starts from the bottom up and works its way all the way up to me. So my goals originate in the goals of the everybody else in the college. They're all tied together. My goals are published and become the goals for the whole college. So we work together because of that. And then if we have a surplus, and we have been lucky enough to do that a few times here, then what we do is take a portion of it and we divide it equally among all the employees who are rated successful or better, which is most all of them. And that way everybody knows if we run our college efficiently and stay in the black and keep our cost under control, everybody gets rewarded for that. And that means it's run like a private business or it's run like a lean nonprofit. And there's no free money coming in here. You know, if somebody offers you a lot of money that you get automatically, as long as you comply with hundreds of pages of rules, what you get good at is complying with rules, and what you get used to is having free money around. And our argument and belief is that's not really very good for you. So that's the reason, and that's the difference.
In our state, you know, we're in tough times. The bureaucracy, the overhead in education in this state is unbelievable. It's suffocating us. It has to change. What will eventually cause it to change?
Well, it's an outgrowth of bureaucratic government. I mean, it's probably true. It's easy to look up, I think. I know in California it was true when I lived there. There are probably more people employed in the public schools in Michigan than there are classroom teachers. Classroom teachers are in the minority, and they probably make less on the average than the non-classroom teachers. So you've got huge amounts of money going to people who are remote from the classroom. And that is characteristic of bureaucratic government. It takes the big top staff to run it, and they got to give lots of orders. And that's got to be changed because the results are terrible. And, you know, I think in Michigan, somebody should look this up, but I'm pretty sure it's true. I think we're spending about $10,000 a kid now. So if it's a classroom of 25, that's $250,000 available to educate those 25 kids. And the teacher makes, you know, with benefits, maybe the teacher makes $60,000 a year. Where does the rest go? Something's got to change that. And you say, how? Well, the answer is, I think if people learn the facts, they will understand that it is, you know, education must be supported for sure. But gosh, this way, it's not good for the kids. It's breaking us. You know, I think it's true in the recent reforms in Michigan. I know it was a recommendation of the Citizens Research Council that we recommend that we let prisoners go to save money. Well, how about more efficiency in the big categories of expenditure? You know, the student-faculty ratio at Hillsdale College is 10 to 1. The student-faculty ratio ought to be like that in the public schools. And, you know, college is different than a school. But, you know, I think the Hillsdale Academy spends about the same amount of money as the state spends. But the student-faculty ratio is, you know, I think the class sizes are 14, something like that. So there's efficiencies to be gained. People should wake up and see that. And by the way, any proper set of reforms would have the effect of empowering teachers and not powerful people who represent the education establishment.
Your life has been guided by principles. If you could have 1 minute in another 3-4 weeks to speak to America during the Super Bowl halftime show, what would you tell America?
This country is built in the name of the principles written in the laws of nature and of nature's God. They recognize what God has established, which is our natural equality, our right to our life, liberty, property, and pursuit of happiness, and our right to be governed only by our consent. And that makes our country the most precious thing in the modern world. And we should love it and respect it and learn about it and obey its constitution.
What are you most concerned about for America today?
People are ignorant. They are the established creed these days is that the only true thing is change, that we humans can be in charge of the process of change. We can perfect the society. We should have a government that seeks to do that, that there are no old truths that are still true. And that is really, you know, it's because of ideas like those I just described. For example, I'll give you a simple. Woodrow Wilson, the only PhD ever to be president, wrote explicitly that the Declaration of Independence and its principles were obsolete, written for a time, he said, accountable to Newton. But now we have Darwin, and we know that government and society must be a living and changing thing. And if that's true, then there are no limits on the government. But the people who built our government thought that an unlimited government was a dangerous government, as well as wasteful. And I worry about that.
We're talking to Dr. Larry Arn, and I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
Trust in Us, a world-class executive search firm, presents Anything is Possible with Jack Rasula on News Talk 760 WJR.
Welcome back. We're with one of the world's experts on Winston Churchill, Dr. Larry Arn. Doctor, anybody that walks into your office, it's Churchill. It's everywhere. Paintings, bust, books, etc. Why the love for Churchill? And talk to us about Winston Churchill.
Well, I started reading Churchill when I was in graduate school. And you can't read... For example, the first thing I ever read by him was the first page of his History of the Second World War, called The World Crisis. And Churchill was a very beautiful writer, and he was a very moving writer. He had a broad, lovely outlook on life, and he loved freedom and justice, and he proved over the course of his life to be very brave in fighting for them. And so the first thing that attracted me was his eloquence. And then later I came to understand and believe that he is a profound man And then gradually it dawns on you just how great a man he was. He wrote 30-some books. He wrote his own speeches. Some of them are the greatest. He would, dealing with questions of public policy, he would write memos sometimes, 3,000, 4,000 words, and they would be lovely. And they were very frustrating to his opponents. So his greatness is a symbol of a thing we all need. Classical thought teaches us to believe this. This is, by the way, something young people should come to understand. The condition of human beings is that they must make choices amidst necessity, and the necessity makes a kind of demand, and right and wrong makes demands. And prudence, which is in classical thought the gift of the statesman, is what he can do. Prudence permits us to reconcile the two, to pick the best course of action given the demands of necessity and given right and wrong. And that great statesman, Calvin Coolidge, said one time, are the ambassadors of providence sent to reveal to us our unknown selves. Churchill was a man like that. Young people who want to read him should know he was a very brave soldier. His early life is like an adventure story. He wrote a lovely little book, which is the first thing anyone should read about him, called My Early Life. And in there are cavalry charges, and there's a prisoner of war camp escape. He becomes a painter in there, eventually a pretty good painter. The story of his life is rich with excitement and adventure. But then also it is profound. And to read a man like that and ask the question, what did he stand for and why, is a very rich experience.
Another person that you really admire, Abraham Lincoln. Share us about Lincoln.
I have studied Lincoln for years, not quite as much as Churchill, but a lot. And just the other night, I have an experience. It's since I saw you last, Jack. I had cause, because I'm teaching a course here, to go back and read a speech that Lincoln gave in 1854 about the Kansas-Nebraska Act, which was a huge turn in the slavery crisis in the history of our country. And about two-thirds of the way through this speech, which everybody ought to go look up, it's given in Peoria, Illinois, in 1854, but it's easy to find on the Internet for free. About two-thirds of the way through, I found myself about to cry because it was so beautiful. It was such a lovely account of what had happened in American history about slavery, about how it was possible to combat it, about why it must not be extended, and about why it was wrong. And, you know, Lincoln's position was a moderate position. He didn't believe that the Constitution gave the federal government the power to interfere in slavery in the states where it existed. And he explains why he thinks that. And then he explains why it must not be allowed to go any further into the federal territory, land not yet organized as states, like Kansas and Nebraska, and why that would be sufficient to achieve its eventual elimination. And it's so clear and so strong and so insightful, and its beauty lies in this. It is the massive ability of some people to figure out how practically to do the right thing, given all the circumstances. And Lincoln was just a master at that, as was Churchill. And so you love them when you read them, once you understand what they're teaching you.
Which people, Dr. Larry Arn, living today, are your heroes?
Well, I like to say, and I mean it, that the greatest man I know is Clarence Thomas. I met him a long time ago before he was a famous man, and I have always admired him very much. I regard him as a great man. My opinions about him are elevated and deepened some by the fact that he turns out to be such a fine justice, in my opinion, again. And if you read his opinions that he writes for the court, you will see that he's a very serious man as a judge, and at least I argue and believe. And I would not have been sure about that from knowing him before. So I do regard him as very great. I know and have, partly because I lived in England in the late 70s when she came to power and worked for Sir Martin Gilbert, the Churchill biography. I happen to know and have known for some time now Margaret Thatcher. We're going to dedicate a statue of her on this campus in May. She might be here for that. And I regard her as a very great person. Watched her work, was awestruck by some of the things she did. And so among the living, those two. And then, you know, I have a few colleagues here in the college that are very admirable people. And to mention one of them would be to offend some others, probably, and so I won't. But I do have a few really close colleagues who are just wonderfully admirable people, and to know them is to love them.
Dr. Larry Arnn, is the American dream still alive?
The answer to that is, of course it is. I mean, look at you, and look at me. My dad's a retired high school teacher from a little bitty town, and I have been able to study the best and the highest things all my life, and to teach them to others. And, you know, I chose to do that, thought that was a great undertaking, and have been able to pursue it. What more could you want? And today, you know, our country is in trouble, but it has often been in trouble. And there are enormous forces in the land to rise up and rescue it, as there have been in the past. So very much it's still alive.
The importance of reading is paramount today. We had George Will on here a few weeks ago, and he said, read, read, read. If there's a listener out there that has a son or daughter that doesn't want to read, what do you say to them, Doctor?
Well, they haven't tried to read the right things, you know? It's like how kids today don't like to read history. And it's just not possible that they can't like to read history if they can ever learn what it is. Because what it is a huge adventure story. And, you know, nothing could be more urgent than people in education, and that means parents to start with, than to search for inspiring things to read and to read them to their children. And then to spend their own time reading as opposed to watching television. Not nearly so worthy an undertaking. And, you know, in my own life, I find, and I have to discipline myself because I'm busy and I read all day long, and sometimes it doesn't feel like reading is relaxation. But I will tell you, when you can make yourself do it, even when you don't want to, it always repays you. And that's George Will is very right about that.
Last question, Dr. Larry Arnn. What advice would you give to our young listeners tonight?
Well, read, but also remember the purpose of your education is a profound form of self-fulfillment. You should set out to learn what you are and what you are for. You are a kind of thing. You're not a dog, and you're not an angel. You are that creature in between. And if you learn to live as you were meant to live, you can be happy. And you should learn how to do that. And that means a good education.
Dr. Larry Arnn, thanks for leading one of our state's greatest treasures. It's an honor to have you.
Honor to me, sir.
Please join us next Sunday. Until then, I'm Jack Krasula. Thanks for listening, and make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spoiler.